There we go. So it's a nice mix of disciplines, and I think anthropology, like bioethics, which can be considered somewhat of an umbrella interdisciplinary field, anthropology is as well. And so, like I said, my classes are me talking and discussion, probably more me talking today just because there's so much that I want to talk about to get you excited and lay some of the stage for the semester. But feel free to interrupt me at any time. A note about my jargon and some of the jargon from the readings. I've said this every class since I started teaching in 2006 in this department. There will be terms on the first day, there will be things that I'm going to say where you're going to go, huh? In the same way that I do when I listen to moral philosophers. It took me 3 years before I had to keep looking up ontological and epistemological. And sometimes I still do. But what I will say is that it will eventually make a lot of sense. And there will come a point, and those of you who've been in my classes will know this and have seen it and know how excited I get when it happens, I will pose a question and somebody will answer a question using the language that I would have used. And without even thinking about it, it just rolls off their tongue. They're talking about social constructionism. They're talking about ideology and social structure. And at that point, yes, that will happen to everybody in the room, for those of you who don't have a social science or anthropological background. A lot of people come to bioethics a little worried that they think they need the bio. You don't. I was a biology major for a semester in college. Until I worked at a marine lab for a semester, and that was horrible. And then I found anthropology. Okay. So, plan for the day. Because of the interdisciplinary nature of anthropology, we've drawn people from a lot of departments around the university. So, a lot of this will be whirlwind tours. I want to lay out what I think bioethics is. Again, you could have 100 different people sitting in this chair talking about what they think bioethics is, and you'd get 100 different answers, maybe 95. But then introduce what is anthropology? What is anthropological? How does anthropology understand medicine? How does it approach medicine? And then the key in all of this is the culture concept. So we'll spend a lot of time on that. We'll relate culture to health in general, theoretical terms, and then we'll put that on a global stage. Then we'll do class introductions and a course overview. And then we'll all go out to dinner. I have two children. One of them is 2 and is being particularly good at it right now. So I look forward to teaching again because I can be like, I'll be home late. Really late. Okay. So, bioethics is a relatively recent field. Most people would put its origins with a couple major events. The Nuremberg trials with the sort of Nazi war medical experimentation, and the revealing of the Tuskegee syphilis experiments. Both of them being quite egregious offenses to humans in the name of medical research. You have sort of the founding documents of bioethics, with the Declaration of Helsinki and the Belmont Report. So bioethics really started as protection of human subjects, or the recognition of the autonomy, the key overriding principle of everybody, of all of the other principles, the protection of first of human subjects and then on the clinical side, patients as well. You have the four biggies, principles of autonomy, justice, beneficence, and non-maleficence. Bioethics people bullet point definitions of those four. Anybody want to do them? The principle of beneficence. Katrina.
Well, this means the best interest of the physician or everyone's in working in cohesion for the best interest of the patient.
Mm-hmm. Sort of classic Hippocratic oath.
Standard best interest.
Yes. Very much related to non-malfeasance. Somebody? Non-malfeasance? fancy way of saying do no harm. That's why I put them together, because do good and do no harm, I mean, again, you could parse them apart, but for our purposes, we don't need to. Principle of justice. It's the one that's probably least talked about in bioethics. Matt, take a stab?
To provide equity and to do well for everyone.
Exactly. Equity in the face of when there is shortages, particularly. You know, you often hear about issues of justice in bioethics when you're talking about organ transplant and organ allocation or limited resources. Art Kaplan talks about justice a lot when he's talking about vaccines in a disaster. How do you allocate resources? And then autonomy, the big one. The respect for self-determination. This is going to be one that by the end of the semester, hopefully everyone in the room will have for those of you who already have a concept of what you think autonomy is, it's going to be quite different by the end of the semester. And for those of you who don't yet have a grasp of what autonomy is, I'm very happy that I can instill in you my version before anyone else gets to you. Like a lot of the theoretical tradition of bioethics, autonomy comes from a very particular tradition. It's a Western Enlightenment philosophical position. It's the autonomous self, the thinking, rational being, able to make decisions. A lot of conflicts in bioethics, and this is where bioethics lives now. It lives at the intersections of this triangle. It's conflict-driven a lot of the times. You know, bioethics exists in universities, it exists in medical centers, it exists at the bedside, you know, where you have a conflict between patient autonomy and physician's desire to do good. When those two ideas of what it means to be autonomous and what it means to do no harm are in conflict. You know, this often comes up for those of you who are taking Autumn's end of life class. This is going that bottom end of the triangle is going to be huge for what you're talking about over there this semester. I want all measures taken, but they're futile. Is it harming the body to continue to treat it in a particular way when it will never become the body or regain the bodiness that it had before? Resource allocations issues. Is it fair and just to take up a bed? So much of bioethics happens in between those triangles. There are a lot of positives to this type of bioethics, which is often just sort of shorthanded as principle-based bioethics. It has done a lot to give power back to the patient, the bottom left corner of that triangle. Moving away from a tradition in which doctor knew best, always. So recognition that individuals should have a right to control what happens to their body. Good's article for this week talks about, you know, a lot of the problem. He talks about what do we do with the problem of irrational beliefs or irrational wants, quote unquote irrational wants. That often is expressed at that bottom. You know, we've got one side claiming the other side is acting irrationally. We're going to make the argument in this class that I never use the word irrational. I think there's very few activities in life that are irrational. And again, I'm excluding people with mental problems that. And I'm just stuck here because I don't want to say I'm excluding people with mental problems that would impair their ability to rationally think, because that makes it sound like I'm talking about only rational actors. But I think you probably know what I mean on a gut level. I'm not talking about people with multiple personality disorders, although it could be kind of a fun thought experiment. This will all make more sense as we go on, because I've now got myself into a circle. So benefits are, it does give voice to the autonomous patient. It is nice to have an outside, impartial-esque group of people overseeing or keeping an eye on what's happening in both clinical care and research. I think there's people in this room that are probably working with the IRB here, Institutional Review Board, monitoring safety studies, making sure patients are protected, recruited in a fair way. However, as an anthropologist, I see a lot of negatives with principle-based bioethics as it's commonly practiced. I think it's, in most cases, completely ahistorical. It's taking a conflict at the bedside and looking and starting there. Oftentimes, the conflict is not looked at from a trajectory as a how did we get here. Questions are often posed as why? Why are you making that decision? Why do you want to do that? You know, why are you asking for this? I think a much better question is how. How did you come to be where you are? How did you come to be asking what you're asking? And that question of how gets us to the contextual nature of individuals in time and space. I think principle-based bioethics, as it's commonly practiced, also doesn't give proper credit to the importance of the power differentials between the players. And I'm not just talking patient-doctor, but also patient-nurse, patient's parents, patient's children. Where is the setting? You know, patients half naked, you know, laying in a bed sick, most often. To not take that into account does injustice, I think, to how we're understanding the patient. We're talking about how much we want to value their autonomy, but what we mean is their rational thought process. But I think the rational thought process cannot be even talked about abstracted from the body that through which that thought is happening. North American contemporary principle-based bioethicists pay very little attention to health on a global scale. They pay very little attention to everyday matters of health, actually. Art Kaplan's probably the most famous bioethicist in the nation. What do we hear him talking about? He's talking about the sort of blockbuster cases, the Terri Schiavos, the pillow angel in Seattle or wherever she was, you know, the parents who of a child who had a mental disability that would keep her constantly at a mental age of 7, but her physical body would develop, and they wanted to do an operation that would sort of curtail her development of puberty and her development of growth so that they could better care for her. They were getting older. They didn't want to have to physically care for a child of mental age of 7, but a body of 30. It's the big cases. It's the cases that make the news. It doesn't pay attention to the fact that I just heard the statistic the other day at Temple University Hospital. They did a study. 30% of discharge orders were given, or no, of all the discharge orders given, they all were dependent upon the patient having a home. But 30% of the people that were discharged were homeless. So that, to me, is a huge bioethics issue. We're talking about how do we make decisions at the end of life? If you're not in a social position to reach a bed being cared for by a team of health practitioners, your end of life, there are no decisions at the end of your life. Sustainable food supplies, safe water, safe streets. I think these are all issues that deserve to be under the rubric of bioethics. Because bioethics is not, as I see it, should not just be about disease and illness, but also needs to be about health and sort of more well-being. And people might say that's too broad, that's too much for one field. But I come from anthropology that studies the history of man in all its entirety. So I'm used to sort of being able to parse through large fields. So I think anthropology is a nice way to broaden bioethics beyond the principle-based approach and make it more applicable, global, and as get to the end of the semester, you will all be saying, yes, it is more ethical if we can do this. All right, so what is this thing that I keep talking about and raving about? Anthropology, as I said, sort of the breakdown of the words, it's the study of man. traditionally it's a four-field approach. A lot of people, you know, when I was saying I, when I became, you know, Dr. Jones as an anthropologist, people were like, oh, just like Indiana Jones. Said, well, okay. I was actually in fourth grade when that movie came out, I think, and people started calling me Dr. Jones, so I feel like I had sort of a path laid out for me. Archaeology, you know, the study of human remains, material culture. It doesn't have to be from eons ago. It could be, you know, when they're doing a dig in Center City to build a new building and they find something from the independence era. Linguistics, the study of how people make meaning through language. There's the physical anthropologist, which are doing a lot of genetics work and human evolutionary work. And then the sort of catch-all for everything else, the cultural anthropologist, also sometimes called sociocultural anthropologist. Really, the focus on the beliefs, attitudes, behaviors, the lived experiences of contemporary people. And that's where I fell. I fell actually into a subdiscipline of cultural anthropology, visual anthropology, which studies the visual products that people make and how to use visual products to study institutions and ideologies. So on the one hand, you have anthropology. On the other hand, you have medicine, which is also the study of man. It's a study of his body, his physiology, his genetics. How do we link the two? We link the two through the concept of culture. And I'm going to give a whirlwind history of the culture concept because just laying out where anthropologists place culture now doesn't give it the same oomph as if we, if I don't give you the beginning. Basically, culture as a term, you know, now we've, you know, it's so commonly used now. There's youth culture, there's office culture, there's this culture, there's that culture. So we're acculturated to understand that we all have culture. didn't always used to be the case. Before group A of people bumped into group B, there was no need to really define culture because it just was. But from the minute group A bumped into group B, that's when you start to say, whoa, okay, that group is different than we are. And that's you have the sort of probably the one human universal that I will claim there is the desire to understand the other. but the desire to understand the other always has a relationship to who's doing the understanding. Definitions of other always, by their nature, reflect back on the person doing the defining. So, you know, you can see in sort of in ancient China, there's records of Chinese civilization. And it's a target-like system. The way they mapped out, the bureaucrats mapped out the kingdom, it was a target. Civilization in the middle. Lesser advanced rural peoples, and, you know, obviously I'm loosely translating, and then barbarians who lived outside the kingdom. You see this with early missionaries in South America. You have Europeans and children of God at the top. You have literate and convertible Indians one step below. Illiterate and non-convertible Indians, and then you have wild savages. They're just hopeless and almost non-human. The Chinese bureaucrats and the Jesuit, or you know, the missionaries to South America had the same goals, and unfortunately, in the same sort of very ethnocentric way. Ethnocentric, you just have to define it. It's more used now to, you know, the idea that you're judging others based on the standards of your own. Similar goals to the early anthropologist, because anthropology as a discipline got its start really probably because of British colonialism. You've got the British Empire, and you know, I'll use them as the sort of scapegoats for all the other ones that were colonizing, going to places and having to govern them. Hello. Here's our dental students. I was explaining at the beginning of class that you guys always come in a little late. Syllabi are there. Going to other cultures and needing somebody, and the rising discipline of anthropology, sort of the study of man, was they were the perfect people to do this. Sort of catalog, document, help the colonizers understand what they had, who they had to deal with, you know, as a means to help govern. It was mutually beneficial. you had colonizing governments who got good information, good intel, you know, things like, all right, you know, if we want to come in here, what is the indigenous structure? Who's at the head? So we can create, you know, what is it, the best, my husband's a political scientist, and he was, you know, yeah, like the king of Jordan. Or I think that's the example he gives. You know, sort of created institutions and created names, mimicking sort of the indigenous structures to help ease the transition. Where was I? So it's mutually beneficial to also to the anthropologist who were making careers. I mean, that sounds really cynical, and I do have a cynical side, and it doesn't come out all the time, I promise. I oscillate between cynicism and optimism. What these anthropologists were doing is going out and cataloging the other cultures. They were doing the same things that the Chinese bureaucrats and the missionaries were doing. They were explaining the customs, traditions, what they ate, what they believed in, how they hunted, what their kinship systems were like. These are the most boring books you will ever read, are these 19th century ethnographies. Ethnography is the story of a culture. There's one, my particular least favorite, by E.E. Evans Pritchard, called The Nuer, which is about 250 pages, 200 of which describing the cattle and how they classify different cattle, because cattle are important, but very dry. So if we buy the argument that in defining others, by default we're defining ourselves, or at least expressing opinions about ourselves, then anthropology, as this very distinct Western discipline, which emerged out of the desire and the goal to understand the other, we can look at anthropology as sort of a tool in our own self-understanding, contrasting European civilization with the primitive or non-Western world. And it is quite a privileged perspective, because what the anthropologists were saying, and this is E.B. Tyler's classic 1871 definition of culture, taken in its broad ethnographic sense, is that complex whole, which includes knowledge, belief, art, morals, laws, customs, and any other capabilities and habits acquired by man as a member of society. Okay. What they were looking at, they were envisioning culture as this thing that existed in the world that could be, an outsider could come in, an educated enough outsider could come in, observe it, catalog it. I forgot to bring in a billiard ball, because that's the perfect visual analogy for what, how they understood culture. It's hard to break a billiard ball. It's solid, it's hard, it's contained. Culture as a thing, a billiard ball. So the world was made up of a whole bunch of billiard balls bumping into each other. Not, if you think of culture as a thing, a laundry list of characteristics, behaviors, material products, internally homogenous, of course, because we're dealing with looking really at primitive peoples, and they're not very advanced. I hope you can hear the sarcasm in my voice, and I'm speaking as an 1871 anthropologist. I don't want anyone to walk out of here and go, God, she seemed okay, but geez, man, ethnocentric out the wazoo. Within this theory of culture as a thing, there's no room for change. It's incredibly reductive. It's deterministic. There's no space for individual agency. How could there be? If culture is this complex whole, you can see how tautological it gets. Well, if ABC culture is this, then an ABCian does that. Okay. but it was not seen as a problem, again, because the lens of anthropology was turned outwards. The theory of culture said, once you observe it and document it, you're done. Three things happened to change this, and they happened in the 1960s. More or less. On the one hand, thing number one, you have, on a large scale, previously colonized people becoming independent. You have in the United States, civil rights movement, women's rights movement. So you have more international students, you have more women, you have more minorities entering the academy, entering this prior domain, which was pretty exclusively, and for the white men in the room, this is also not a white man bashing class, but again, let's put ourselves in a situation that we're not European males trained in the Enlightenment tradition. They were coming and saying, all right, these ethnographies that have been written where I have been a subject, that doesn't describe who I am in the least. So there's something wrong with what they were describing as what culture was. You've got anthropology graduate students who are now coming through the ranks. They need a dissertation site. They need their field work site, because that's what characterizes anthropology. You got to go somewhere for a year, because again, you got to do the whole planting season, because that's what primitive people do. They plant things and they have festivals, and you need to see all 12 months of them. Mm-hmm. I did my field work at the Mutter Museum in Philadelphia. It had to be a year. There's no rituals, yearly rituals at the Mutter other than the Mutter Ball, you know, these sorts of things. So you have anthro grad students coming up needing fieldwork sites, and there's no more undiscovered people. There's no more new place to go. So their professors were all people who had made their careers. Anthropologist A, culture A. Anthropologist B, culture B. So like, well, I guess you could go back. Maybe, you know, they really were. I mean, I can put myself in the position of these tenured professors thinking, what am I going to do with this student? You know, I've already documented the culture. What is she going to do? And they went and found completely different stories. And also heard stories about when their professors were there and saying, oh, yeah, we just told them that. So the idea that informants could lie, oh my God, it was a huge crisis for anthropology. The idea, people would say, like, well, you've got a Coca-Cola shirt on, you know, and you're wearing a wristwatch. I'm like, oh yeah, you know, we do that. And so you have a shock to the system. If you have a billiard ball model of culture, this stuff makes no sense. And then you have the publication of Malinowski's diary. Malinowski, Bronislaw Malinowski, was one of these anthropologists who wrote these incredibly boring ethnographies. In his case, the Argonauts of the Western Pacific, about the people in the Trobriand Islands. And after a kind of a bitter divorce and then his death, his ex-wife published his diaries that he had written while he was in the field. And he comes across as very unsure of himself and very, you know, how do I meet people? You know, he had one or two key informants. So whereas the ethnography was written in the third person, they believe this, they do this, these are their traditions, his diary is saying, okay, well, I talked to so-and-so who showed me how to build a boat. So again, the sort of crisis of anthropology of the 60s led anthropologists to say, all right, the idea of culture as a thing no longer can hold water. The billiard ball is irrevocably broken. And it also said, you know what, if we take the theory and apply it to ourselves, you know, we can see ourselves how the billiard ball doesn't work for American culture, because right now sort of, you know, we've gone from the British to the Americans, which is where we'll focus it. You know, there's no, you can't really say there is an American culture in the sense of a billiard ball. So we move to thinking, all right, well, I mean, that's not how, it sounds very flippant. It moved from thinking of culture as a thing to culture as a process of socialization. What's significant about looking at culture as a process is that it means we all have it, and we are all implicated in the lives of others. So those of you who are sitting here like, what does that do to global health? This is where you can start to see where this culture concept is going to play a huge role when we're talking about health on a global scale. We are all implicated in the lives of others through the theory of culture that is a sort of a social constructionist. I'll use social construction, culture as a process, somewhat interchangeably. And this is, here's a quote from, I think, Crandon Malamud, who's the ethnographer we're going to read, we're not. Culture is not a thing somewhere out there that books are about. Culture is a process of making meanings, making social relations, and making the world that we inhabit. in which all of us are engaged, when we read and teach or when we diagnose and treat, no less than when we embroider nayas and conduct sacrifices. So culture as a process levels the playing field of culture as well, which is important when we're talking about global health. There's no more privileged perspective. It's a perspective that comes from methodological training, theoretical training, and the ability to sort of have two eyes at once. We talk about anthropologists having to be reflexive, and that just means the idea being that, all right, I know what I'm looking at, but I also have to know enough about who I am and where I'm looking to help me make sense of what I'm looking at. I can no longer say with any authority, that is ABC. We sort of shorthand it, but what we mean is, from my vantage point, at this particular moment in time, in this particular context, given these particular social and structural constraints of how we're related to each other, this is the situation. And so right there, you kind of see too that it fleshes out what's happening. And I'm sort of speaking to the anthropologist and the nurses and the social workers and the bioethicists in sort of two breaths here. It speaks to the problems that are happening at the bedside. I do have a prop for the theory of culture as a process, the social constructionism of culture. I had to bring a prop because I did this talk, something very similar in a global health class at Jefferson, and I was talking about slinkies, and there were some international students in the room, and finally they raised their hand and they're like, what is a slinky? This is a slinky. I think it is, again, I'm a visual anthropologist, so this helps me. So if you're thinking on your train ride home tonight, okay, what was that theory of social constructionism as a process? Think slinky. Aha, all right. What this means is that this is a person's life. And if we want to get metaphysical, we can say it extends beyond through their family or their ancestors or their predecessors or whatever. But okay, let's just take a person's life. At any particular point in that person's life, how do we understand that? We have to understand it from what happened before. And I like the slinky because it turns in on itself. It's hard to get a 90-degree angle in a slinky. You can, but I think it would symbolize a major life trauma to have a 90-degree angle in somebody's life slinky. Because this idea of socialization can happen both on an individual level and a cultural level. So I'm thinking both ways. I realized as I was talking that I slipped into the individual. But cultures as well, okay. Here's the Trobriand Islands in 1997. Here's the Trobriand Islands in 1947. To understand, you can look at social forces. Oh, you know, there's a world war. there's an anthropologist. There's some colonialism. So if you think of how a slinky moves, it can respond to social pressures on both a cultural level and an individual level. We are constantly learning new things. We're meeting new people. Cultures are bumping into each other. An invention comes in. Somebody sells them some fighter jets. Something happens. So change within a culture or an individual. Sorry, people on the tape. Culture is up high. People are down low. Not really, but okay. Not in a judgmental sense. It can bend. Change can happen very slowly, and you can have a compacted slinky. Change can happen really fast. Slinkies can get tweaked, as this one just did. They can end up entangled at the bottom of a toy box. They very rarely break. Again, that would be a major trauma. So the idea of social constructionism is that change happens in a very particular way in response to the trajectories that have happened before it. Some of you may have heard the idea of culture being described as a web. I kind of like that too, but slow your slinky through the web. The web being, all right, you've got trajectories of history, economics, religion, politics, whatever you can think of. An individual, if we're talking on an individual level, is situated in that web somewhere. All of those trajectories. The fact that I am sitting here, as a getting older white woman is a consequence of the particular trajectory in which I was embedded. The fact that I had the choice to go to grad school. The fact that certain cultures are able to do the things they're doing almost have, well, do I want to say don't have anything to do with? I'm not sure yet. Very little to do with anything internal to the culture. I mean, obviously, there are internal choices, there are internal actors, there's internal institutions, but those are all embedded in those webs, in the slinky. Does that make sense? This idea that, I guess the main point is that culture is not a billiard ball, it's a slinky. Culture is not a thing that people just have. Culture is a thing that people are born into. Culture is a thing that is malleable and flexible and contingent upon the forces around it. It, culture, it, person. That's why we, you know, sort of the idea that we talked, we started this whole conversation about culture, that we all exist in multiple cultures can make sense because there's different paths that we've taken based on all the different facets of who we are. Does that help? We're going to spend all next week talking about culture and bioethics and culture on a, what does culture mean in a global health context? So, what time is it? Yikes, okay. I want to leave it there for now. Just meditate on the slinky. And next week, after you've had a chance to read more, because we're going to be reading public health people, anthropologists, physician-type people, all talking about culture. So no matter where you're situated disciplinarily, there's someone talking in your language about what culture is. This is one of those ones where you're going to love the slinky halfway through the semester. So adapting this concept of culture to culture as something that is constructed, culture as a process. What that also does is it says, all right, outsiders then are not the main classifiers of what's going on. That position is occupied by the human beings who are actors. It is always the major task in anthropology to find the actor's classifications. This is not quite the same thing as asking him why he is acting. That's what I mentioned when I started this little diatribe on culture. It's not why. The question is not why. The question is how. How did you come to be acting the way you are? And that how question is going to be so important over the course of this semester because we're going to be talking about, well, how did this drug trial happen to take place in this culture? How did people come to respond the way they did? How did disaster relief agencies come to make the decisions they made? How did the response to disaster A come to differ from disaster B? How did the consequences of those things happen? If you catch me asking the question why, stop me and rephrase it to how. Socialization, the questions of how do we construct knowledge, how are we motivated to act, how are emotions elicited, how do we come to understand our health and our bodies and illness. That's exactly what's at the core of public and global health. It's what's at the core of any ethical problem. And it can happen on a macro and a micro level. All right, so what does all this have to do with health? It's a hard question here to answer because we here consider, I think most of us probably, growing up where we did and living where we are and taking full advantage of all the medicine that we can, the everyday quality of medicine as scientific knowledge, as what's going on in our bodies, as physiology, as increasingly as genetics, has an everyday quality. Medicine is, and medical science are in many ways seen as acultural. Medicine is one of those things that has just continued to develop and get better and get more true and get more right as we've moved along. Biomedicine, though, biomedicine itself has its own slinky. It has its own trajectory that is, if those of you who are interested in the social history of medicine, Paul Starr's The Social Transformation of Medicine, unfortunately it was written in, I think, 1985, so it ends right when things kind of get interesting, but he didn't know that, talks about the battle between the homeopaths and the allopaths and the American Medical Association and the competing medical associations, how it was set up, how doctors' records it developed as sort of a single file, how payment worked, how insurance worked. All of this is incredibly culturally contingent, and he traces the history back to particular institutions, particular charismatic personalities who really drove the direction that medicine, how it ended up. The fact that biomedicine is based on the scientific method, that it's evidence-based, that it's technologically driven, that it's fixated with the idea of the broken part metaphor. That's what organ transplantation, broken part, sort of fix it. The idea that a death is sort of a technological failure. These are all very particular consequences of a particular social history. The idea that everything reduces to the physical realm of organs, organ function, body chemistry, etc., it didn't have to sort of necessarily work that way. If you look at those of you who've been through medical education, how does medical education start? You start with gross anatomy. So let's say if you want to look at arthritis of the knee, you dissect the knee with arthritis. Then maybe you look at tissue samples under the microscope. Then you might do some genetic work on sort of, I don't know, what causes arthritis or what other effects does it have? Only then, in your third year, maybe your second, do you see a patient with arthritis of the knee. So, Kazune, what is important for this physician when he's looking at the patient? That in France, they do a year or two of signs and symptoms first. They see patients. They talk to patients. They listen to patients. What does arthritis of the knee feel like? How does it, how did it manifest? How does it affect your life? Quite distinct visions of what medical science could be, and also quite distinct then modes of interaction with patients. Every person who's been in the hospital here has heard the shorthand of, oh, it's the liver in room 6. That's the this in room 7. That does not happen in other parts of the world. But we here don't see the cultural nature, the cultural factors that make up Western biomedicine. And anthropologists didn't either. When they started looking at medicine, this is where I love the good article for today. If you didn't get a chance to read it, do so. There's a section in the middle where he talks about sort of the origins of the idea of belief, which is interesting from sort of a religious philosophical standpoint, but his evidence of sort of the difference between knowledge and belief is what we're talking about here, that anthropologists went to go study other people's medical traditions, and they were written as histories or stories of their religious beliefs, because it was, they believe that, this sort of spirit causes X, Y, or Z, or it's, a cursing from a community member that causes D, E, and F. Consequences of this, idea that if, Western biomedicine just is, we know it is, other people have beliefs. We see this in informed consent, or mediation of conflicts. If only we could get the patient to understand really what was going on, he would make the right decision. I've heard doctors say that right and left. They just don't understand. We just need to make them understand. If only those people in Africa would know how AIDS was transmitted, or HIV was transmitted, the problem would be solved. Because the consequence is we privilege and value so much the biomedical way of understanding the world that we, as a remedy to people's problems, think we just need to correct their beliefs. And it's often within bioethics, unfortunately, this is why I gave the history of culture, the way that culture, when it is incorporated into bioethics, its culture is a billiard ball. This is why med students hate cultural competency classes that are given, not by me, because it's cultural competency as, here's the Chinese-American billiard ball. You know, here's the Asian-American billiard ball. Here's the African-American billiard ball. You know, so when you get one of these patients, here's what you should do. It becomes a checklist. So bioethics incorporating the other is good because it does say that, all right, you know, maybe there might be some differences in how, in if people want to be told the truth or not. Maybe there are differences in how people understand what it means to have a good death. But the less good comes because of this, I put it in quotes, a wrong understanding of what culture is. I am going to, let's see, it is 5:19. I'm going to skip ahead. I knew I'd jam too much in here. I want to give an alternative understanding. How can we reconcile? Because I think a lot of you are probably going, but medicine is right. Of, you know, cancer is abnormal growth of cells. That's what it is. Anthropologists aren't saying that cancer isn't abnormal growth of the cells. I suppose post-humanists or, you know, really post-modernists might say that, but most of us aren't. What we're saying is Kleinman has most eloquently illustrated it. And in the same way, in the Good article, where he talks about Morgan delineating kinship between descriptive and classificatory, that's what Kleinman did for illness and disease. He said, all right, there's something called disease. Those are the physiological, that's in the physiological realm. And I'm going to post these slides online. Abnormalities in the structure and or function of organs and organ systems, pathological states, whether or not they are culturally recognized. So the relativist in here would be, well, that's imperial. Well, no. we're doing a good middle ground. It's the arena of the biomedical model. But then he said there's also illness, and that's a person's perceptions and experiences of certain, he calls them socially disvalued states, including but not limited to disease. Sickness is the interplay of these two things. It's used as a term to describe events involving disease and or sickness, and that's the domain of anthropology. That's, and through the culture concept. So this is going to be key throughout the semester, because we're going to be reading case studies of non-Western medical systems, of public health and global health interventions in other parts of the world. It's going to be very tempting to say, but what do they really suffer from? Kleinman gives us a way to ask that question. What is, but we have to rephrase, it's not what are they really suffering from, it's what is their disease. But equally important is what is their illness. Because if you just treat the disease, but you haven't done anything for the person's perceptions and experiences of that disease, how much have we really done? And if we're putting this on a global health arena, on an individual level, it makes a lot of sense. But on a global health, what we're really talking about is population-based. That's another sort of issue that we're going to deal with throughout the semester, is going back and forth between treating individuals and treating population, or intervening on a population level. If you want to have a population-based intervention that is going to help eliminate or cut down incidence of disease, you've got to understand the illness. And to understand the illness, you've got to have an understanding of that culture, not as a thing, but as a slinky, which means we're going to have a certain understanding of anthropological and qualitative methods, which are in the syllabus. We'll be talking about those. Because all on the flip side, what he says, curing is anything that affects the pathological organic state. So you cure a disease, you heal individuals. So if you want to take this to a population-based, sure, you can cure disease on a population level, but if you want to have an impact on the health of the population, you also have to think about healing, not just curing. How are we so far? Okay, I got one good. I got some nods. and you know, they are convoluted in the sense, I mean, individually they're not, but putting them together, I must have sat in preparing the slides for tonight for about 15 minutes going, okay, anthropology first, health first, culture first, bioethics first, because they really could go in almost any order. Because I think where we just got in terms of individual, population, culture, disease, health. Did I say culture? I'll say it again because it's so important. They exist in this just amorphous, continually moving, you know, it's like the earth. You don't feel it turning, but it is. You know, we're on that slinky right now. And I say that not to be sort of discouraging because, well, how are we ever, you know, going to get ahead of the slinky? You know, no, it's, you've got a culture over here suffering an indiscriminately heavy burden of disease. We're over here with our public health interventions, our global health programs. The goal is to get those slinkies to work together for a while. Anthropologists often sort of say, well, what really makes an anthropologist? And you say, well, an anthropologist is someone who has three births. Your first birth is your birth into your home culture. It's the one that you're enculturated in from a small kid, from a small child. It's, you know, what do I need to know to get around in the world so that I don't keep bumping into people and making a fool of myself and stumbling over myself? And, you know, we sort of learn by doing. And then the second birth, all those things that have become second nature. Again, we don't think about culture when we think about ourselves. It's just, well, that's just the way it is. When we go to another culture to do field work, and you have that culture shock experience, anyone who's traveled extensively or lived in another country, when you enter that second country for the first time, and you know, I moved to Venezuela after getting my PhD in anthropology, and I was still like, this doesn't make any sense. Those people are doing it wrong. And you know, my husband's Venezuelan, he's looking at me funny, and you know. Culture shock is inevitable. So I'm not, you know, again, I'm not saying anthropologists are above culture shock, you know. No. But that's the struggle. It's sort of like, all right, Nora, be reflexive. Understand this, appreciate it. Be born into it, come on. So the idea is things start to make sense in the second culture. The third birth is when you come back to your home culture and go, oh, all those things that I thought were self-evident, you can see the slinky. It's like the Matrix. you see it after you've been out of it for a while. And that only enriches, I think, your understanding of your social positioning. You mentioned in the beginning that bioethics proper has those four main principles: justice, autonomy, beneficence, and non-malfeasance. I think that what global health and global bioethics has to offer is almost sort of an overlying principle of an expanded version of justice or fairness or equality or interconnectedness. The principle of interconnectedness, I think, is huge. It's one of those things, it's so self-evident of why it's huge. You know, and again, it's hard for me to articulate it because it, on such a gut level, feels right to me. We'll see in a minute some slides about the global burden distribution of disease. If it doesn't hit you in your gut, it's like, this is wrong, then perhaps maybe a global health course isn't the best place to be. Go to philosophy. Sorry, philosophers. I pick on you only because I love you. And if you are a hardcore moral philosopher in the class, I look forward to having some debates. All right. It takes a strong act of consciousness to denaturalize disease and contemplate it as a cultural domain. That's a good quote from the article from this week. And I highlighted here because I know, and every once in a while I struggle too, although I'm pretty much on the relativist bandwagon and the cultural structuralist bandwagon. It's hard to make that leap from things to do with health and disease are biomedical, and that's how we solve them, to things that have to do with health and disease are cultural, and that's how we have to solve them or address them. So it is hard, and that's what we're going to be working on throughout the semester. And the question, what do we do with beliefs of others that strike us as completely irrational? You know, I mentioned earlier that one of the important things that anthropology can add to bioethics and global health is the recognition of power differentials. This is particularly important on a global health scale, because while that question is often asked at the bedside in a clinic, my God, why is this person doing this? And you can say it's a little bit sort of paternalistic and hierarchical for the physician or the healthcare team to make those judgments. Imagine that amplified when you are a public health agency or a global health agency or an aid agency or one country looking at another country and going, my God, what do we do with them? What they do and believe is completely irrational. Virgins to cure AIDS? That's irrational. What do we do with that? So the idea of thinking of ourselves and our own slinky, hopefully, that's my timer to let me know that I have to move on to the video, should help, thinking of culture as a slinky should, I hope, help level the playing field in terms of what it is to have culture, what it means to be embedded in a culture, the power that culture has over us. I'm not saying it levels the playing field in terms of north-south divide or rich country, poor country. That's not what I'm saying. But in terms of there is no primitive culture, there is no advanced culture, every culture is equally advanced and meets it because they all meet their needs. I don't know, if you want to pull the Marxist side out of my brain, I could make the argument that the culture we have now is less advanced. You know, you could have a lot of fun with it. I wasn't going to let that party me out today. all right. So, and I apologize. I meant to talk faster or less. And I promise I will never talk this much in class again. It will be more discussion-based. And I can stay after a little bit if anyone has burning questions about slinkies or culture. But keep in mind, that will be the main topic of next week, because it's so important to understand culture that we're going to spend next week on it. So global health. So we've talked about anthropology, we've talked about bioethics, we've talked about culture. What is this thing called global health? It's a lot like public health, but population-based, but it takes it to a global scale. It transcends national boundaries. And it pays attention to both global and local forces. What I like about, and I think will be come in handy, because we're not doing this class in a public health school. We're not doing it as part of a global health program. We're doing it as part of a interdisciplinary bioethics program, which means my focus, also because I'm not a classically trained public health person, is that my perspective is going to be a lot broader. I believe that a lot of the key tenets that we're going to be talking about in terms of population-based and attending to the global and local forces can apply to Zimbabwe and North Philly, because the theoretical perspective, because of the basic theory and putting us all within it, we've all got it, we're all embedded in it, the theories can be applied anywhere. You hear a lot about the rising global, on a global level, life expectancies everywhere are rising. Yeah, but then you get hit with those WHO statistics, 10,000 babies die every day before they're 4 weeks old. These numbers are so infathomable, they're infathomable. it's like I always thought those, they don't do them anymore, but when I was in high school, all those, how many people are dying every day from AIDS, safe sex, go get yourself tested. The numbers were so big and so scary that you almost sort of cut down, you shut down. You're like, that doesn't make any sense to me. So just looking at statistics, like epidemiologists might, or like a lot of public health scholars might, you know, yeah, we could go, God, 10,000 babies. 529,000 women die every year in childbirth. 750,000 plus children die every year of measles. 1.6 every year of TB. We could do that and kind of go, wow, geez, whoa. But I think on some level, it's not going to hit us. And that's why probably this and this are the only charts that I may ever show. Because how I think is a better way to grasp the scope of the problem is to read articles that are based in on-the-ground qualitative field work, so that we are told the numbers, but we're also shown the person, and we're shown the slinky. You know, because if I spend that whole time talking about how important culture is and how important trajectories are, this just sits there. It doesn't go anywhere. It doesn't lead us anywhere other than wrong. You know, I don't know, give the Gates Foundation more money to vaccinate people. It's a stopper of the conversation. But I lay them out there just to give us, to hopefully make it a starter, or at least have it sit there somewhere. I found this one too. I don't have numbers to go with these, but the idea that 30% of all deaths in low and middle income countries are due to communicable diseases, I think is communicable preventable diseases. Diseases that we have vaccines for, is quite astonishing. And to just, again, if we're using culture as a thing, we would say, oh, well, it's because that culture doesn't understand the value of vaccines, or it's not in their cultural tradition to vaccinate. That doesn't get us anywhere either. We have to situate the culture in question in a global on a global scale, with the local and global power differentials. Paul Farmer, who is the book that we'll be reading, half of, that's his big focus, is you have to understand the structural constraints of the actors that you're dealing with, because you can't keep it at the level of belief, because that's not the root cause of the problem. The belief stems from structural constraints. That's the root cause of the problem. Why care about all this? Other than the fact that there's a plethora of ethical and moral issues, you know, of just justice and fairness and interconnectability. You know, if you want to take a consequentialist, it took me 3 years to use that correctly in a sentence. Diseases don't respect national boundaries. So, you know, self-interest here. We want to have an impact on global health because people can get on planes and germs travel. We should also care because health and disease are linked with economic and social development. That's what we're going to see in the video. The number one indicator of poor health or poor outcomes is less money. And there's also global security questions, which on all of these we'll be talking about throughout the semester. Took my clock away. Okay. We do have a couple minutes. The video that I want to show, one of the TED Talks. And how many of you are here familiar with Hans Rosling, or have you pronounced his name, and the Gapminder? Oh, you're going to love him. I know. And they are the best stats you've ever seen. This is one of his earlier ones. It runs about 19 minutes. So, but I want to pause and take a breath and drink some coffee. Comments, questions, anything from the whirlwind tour of bioethics and culture anthropology that we've just done. Twelve weeks seems like a lot, but when you're planning a syllabus, you realize it's not that much. I'll reiterate for those of you who came in late, I really don't want anyone to panic. If inside you're going, I have 1,000 questions, but I don't want to ask them because no one else is raising their hand. We will be coming back to these issues. We'll be reading about them in different ways, through different types of authors. I guarantee you it will make sense. I don't guarantee that you're going to embrace it or agree with it or love it, but it will make sense. Okay. Let us watch. I'll let him explain, because this is very early, so he sort of explains the origin of the Gapminder project. And it's a public database, and you can go home, you're going to go home and play with it and watch every single one of them. It's amazing.
About 10 years ago, I took on the task to teach global development to Swedish undergraduate students. That was after having spent about 20 years together with African institutions studying hunger in Africa. So I was sort of expected to know a little about the world. And I started in our medical university, Karolinska Institute, an undergraduate course called Global Health. But when you get that opportunity, you get a little nervous. I thought, these students coming to us actually have the highest grade in the Swedish college system, so I thought maybe they know everything.
He was showing global things when he, like, separated an individual country out. He showed how important local was.
Mm-hmm. At one point, he even said, regional level's too big.
Yes.
Which I'm sure strikes fear in the heart of many public health workers, because, like, how are we supposed to manage anything if regional's too big? So yeah, definitely.
It certainly gets at the importance of contextualizing your data. And like you said, if we keep thinking about, like, he's thinking about data, or if we're thinking about anthropology in terms of a solid billiard ball, we're losing a lot of the uniqueness and the complexity of the data or the situation that we're looking at. And there's a lot more than a lot more complexity than you would normally think, or than has theoretically been discussed before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Was that a hand or a hair flip?
Oh, it wasn't a hand, but okay. This is not a very good comment, because I feel like this really doesn't get to what you're asking. But so I first saw this video when I was working on my master's thesis, and my friend sent it to me as, like, to, like, cheer me up, to, like, as, like, kind of incentive. And I think just, like, one of the points that I just kind of took away from it was, like, the way he spoke about the individual countries like Bangladesh, in terms of, like, when the women started to get involved in, like, family planning, and how much that shifted that spot on the graph. And I just think that, like, too frequently it's really easy to feel, I mean, this is just kind of coming from, like, a really, like, you know, soft, fluffy part of my personality of, like, you know, let's stay a little bit optimistic, but it's really easy, especially what you were saying about, like, thinking locally about rather than thinking globally, that when you think globally, you're getting incredibly discouraged and not seeing the changes that we're making. And I think that when you break it apart and you see the effects of, like, individual populations and groups, it can get a lot more heartening, and you can kind of start to sort of see the pieces and how they work as a whole. Mm-hmm. And see how, like, by affecting the specific pieces, how you can, like, kind of reshape the world. Mm-hmm. Which I just really liked. But yeah, it doesn't really answer your question, sorry.
It does, and it was not I don't think you used the word stupid, but you used another adjective. It wasn't whatever adjective you used.
Fluffy?
It wasn't fluffy. Exactly. When he makes the point about, you know, when he's bursting the countries and he's bursting the bubbles, and he says, and it's not just money, you know, that's where a lot of international work, there's not enough money. Well, yes, you need money to do things, but I think what he's pointing out, when you, when you mention sort of the women, and, you know, he mentions, you know, different groups advocating family planning that didn't before, These are all things that can happen that can have significant changes that may not necessarily have to have a huge chunk of money behind them. I think if you look at the sort of the key things, hopefully, and I realize this is a horrible way to leave on a first day, but I hope that a whole bunch of concepts that you had when you came in are now destabilized. I'm going to leave you on rocky ground. And the concept of illness. You walked in here thinking you knew what it meant to be sick. We've broken apart through Kleinman, or we've cracked the concept of what it means to be sick. We've broken sick into disease and illness. We've destabilized our understanding of what it means to have ill health. We've destabilized what we thought we knew about culture. I'm sure probably none of you thought really seriously when you walked in here that culture was a billiard ball, but the idea that culture is a thing that you have, I don't think is that foreign of an idea for most people that aren't thinking about anthropology all the time. So we've destabilized what culture means. We've thrown in these terms social constructionism. Culture is a process. The slinky model of culture. So we've destabilized that. And I think what the Gapminder video does is it destabilizes our understandings. I love that slide when he first starts. He says, we and them. Western third world. And he destabilizes everything we think we know about how the world looks, because we're looking at billiard balls placed on a map. So those that tripartite destabilization, again, should not be like, oh, shoot. It should be, oh, interesting, how can I rebuild this mountain so that the world makes more actionable sense, that the world makes better sense, that the world makes more ethical sense, or our interventions in it can make more ethical sense. All right, time. All right, 10 minutes, cool, okay. I'd like to spend the last 10 minutes going over the syllabus so you have an idea of what to expect and where we're going over the course of the semester. I want to do the calendar first and then the requirements. I use Blackboard a lot. I post announcements, I send emails about events that are happening around campus. Details of the one book to buy, Paul Farmer, The Modern Plagues. I didn't have it ordered to the bookstore because I think it's cheaper and easier to just order it online. And as students, you get Amazon free shipping. It's such a popular book, you could probably find it in almost any used bookstore in Philadelphia. And we're not really reading it for another couple weeks, so it's not like something you have to have for next week. And if for some reason, let me know if there's a run on Paul Farmer books on all of the online sites, I can scan the chapters and upload them. Or if for any other reason you want me to scan them and upload them, I can. All right. Next week, we'll really focus our lens on, and I've put global bioethics as opposed to global health, because I want, by the term global bioethics, I want us to look at the questions of universalism versus relativism. You know, a lot of people claim that really bioethics is this universal set of principles that can be applied everywhere, sort of the Ruth Macklins of the world. And then there's another group of people, sort of the Lee Turners and the Paul Farmers of the world, that are more situationally relativist. And I want to start there because I think that really will help us understand where we're coming from. In the same way that Autumn and 601 will say, you got to figure out if you're a consequentialist or a deontologist. You know, it's important to figure out to what extent are you a universalist or what extent are you a relativist. And I don't mean that, you know, all morality is completely relative. You know, the classic example is the Brazilian babies, you know, the tribal group in Brazil that occasionally will leave malformed babies out to die. You say, well, they're killing babies. Well, culturally, one can make the argument in that culture, those are not humans. So the universal principle of do not kill people is still being upheld. You know, that's sort of the extreme example. Everyone goes, well, how can you be an anthropologist, you know, and sanction that? I'm like, I'm not sanctioning it. And if I were there, I would personally pick up the baby and take the baby with me. You know, I wouldn't yell at the people. I wouldn't call the Brazilian authorities, but I would take that baby with me. So it's, how does each individual decide how they want to look at the world? So that's what we're going to lay out. You want to be a universalist? You want to be a relativist? Which you do, trust me. It's a much more comfortable position to be in. And there's a degrees of relativity, so you don't have to be the extreme. No one's going to accuse you of being a Brazilian baby killer. And a lot of these articles, so the first one, they're anthropologists. We've got a bioethicist. Kleinman is a physician. It's long, but it's really good, but I put it as recommended. Then week three, we'll talk about international development and disaster medicine, because that's often the first point of contact for a lot of Western physicians and healthcare workers with an international setting. There's a crisis, people want to help. It's also the first glimpse that a lot of American or Western public has of other cultures and health problems in other cultures is when you talk about disasters or outbreaks of communicable diseases. Dr. McGreevy will be joining us. And I've assigned one article. It's from Developing World Bioethics, and it's designed for instructors of global health students. But it's just, I assigned it because I think it's interesting to see what the people who are teaching global health think is important about global health. And Dwight Conkergood, who's an anthropologist, and I think will illustrate quite nicely how to work in a refugee camp sort of setting, and he gives some great examples of the right way and the wrong way. Week four, June 15th, we're really just going to focus exclusively on Farmer. His book is divided into two sections, the first on HIV/AIDS and the second on tuberculosis. We have a week later on HIV/AIDS, so we're just going to focus on his TB stuff. Week five, international research methods and anthropological methods. A lot of global health development work talks about using qualitative methodologies, such as rapid assessment procedures, that are based on in-depth anthropological fieldwork. So the idea being, if I'm up here saying that we have to do in-depth fieldwork, if we've got people telling us that you've got to go local, how on earth are you supposed to do that? How are you supposed to get the data? You can't, or could you? Probably not, because you need someone to translate. You can't just pluck up someone from inside the culture, because they need to, that person that you pluck up to be your informant needs to also have that same reflexive tendency so that they can situate themselves. A whole host of issues. Dr. Barchi will be coming in. She has done a lot of work in Botswana on child infant mortality and violence against women. And she's going to be an interesting case. She is highly reflexive. She works with John Mers a lot, and it's funny because he is so by the book sort of numbers, and he is a universalist to the extreme, and she is a relativist and tempers him, so it'll be sort of fun. But she's very reflexive. She spent her whole dissertation research approaching her data in a very particular way, got it back, analyzed it, realized it didn't tell her anything. And so she's going to be talking about the lessons that she learned about doing data and doing data collection and data analysis, and how one can incorporate qualitative methodology into a research plan, and also the assumptions that we make as Western researchers, how to recognize those so that we don't assume we know what we're looking at. She gives this great example of, we all think we would know what it would mean to look at a house, but unless someone tells you that a house is all the buildings associated with a particular cooking hearth, you've got no idea what a house is. So if you're doing household analysis and you've gone in there with what you think is a house, again, pretty basic concept, house, your data is completely wrong because you've misunderstood how people are relating to each other and what the networks are. All right, week six. That one might change. I'm not really happy with that one. So it's more about sort of relating this to sciences. I really don't like it. I'm going to replace that. So never read more than 3 weeks ahead of time. week seven and eight. relate to each other, but I've broken them up in terms of, they both have to do with global health, global money. It's the influence of international corporations, the pharmaceutical industry, and dollars and research on health. The first half is things that have to do with pharma and governments that aren't vaccine related, because that's in week 8. Vaccines has such an interesting social history and is such a major component of a lot of global health efforts that it needs its own week. But it's tied to research, it's tied to pharmaceuticals, it's tied to money. So the first week is more of an overview, doing more sort of studies and pharmaceutical development and international research ethics proper, and then we'll focus on vaccines. And this is, vaccines are great to look at too, because it really, you know, you get, with ethnographic data, you get things like, well, what were the rumors? How did people understand this? That you can't get in just statistical numbers. Week 9, again, HIV/AIDS is such a big push in international development. It deserves its own week. Week 10, I've left open because my guess is we're going to be behind. But I also want to leave space open to play it by ear. If you guys are like, you know what, we've done 2 weeks and we just did the HIV/AIDS week, we're done with pharmaceuticals, we're done with vaccines, we can easily figure out what would fit in there. I think medical tourism would be a great thing. In fact, maybe I'll put that in that week that I didn't like. Traveling overseas for organ transplants. Again, this is not something that's considered in the domain proper of global health, but if we're looking at health on a global scale, poor people selling organs needs to be included in the conversation. Week 11 is, we're having a rare, Dr. Ikoku is an MD, PhD. He was supposed to come in the spring and couldn't. Autumn has said he is the best speaker she has ever heard. And when I knew his topic, I was like, hey, Autumn, can I get a summer colloquium? Because normally we don't have colloquia in the summer. He has a short reading that we're going to read, and this is a colloquium, so it's open to everybody. Talking about narrative, autobiographical and also sort of fictional narrative, as a means to understand and help make sense of global health issues. So I think that's going to be a nice counterpoint, because we may have been so bogged down in ethnographic studies or statistics that it's going to be nice to have a different perspective. You know, Things Fall Apart is one of the books that has changed a lot in how the world understands itself. And that you know, so looking at narrative is going to be important. In week 12, I think it's important to bring the story, as I say, bring the story home. Take the theoretical perspectives that we've explored, the methodology we've explored, the means of problem solving in other cultures, and bring them to a multicultural, industrialized Western setting. So Lee Turner, who's probably my favorite anthropologist / bioethicist, Bioethics in a Multicultural World. And then Mueller, who is just sort of a nice synthesis piece at the end. That's the one where you're going to read, and you're going to read Social Constructionism, and you're not even going to pause. And also I'm teaching in the fall Cultural Competency in Medicine, which is sort of a lot of these same issues, but focused exclusively on the United States. And I'm also been getting more involved. Temple University has a Center for Urban Bioethics and Medical Humanities, sort of urban health issues. And I'll be working with them over the summer and the fall. So I am so 100% engulfed in all of these issues that I wanted to help myself and help the story in a seamless transition. Any questions about what we're covering? And then we'll quickly end with what we have to do. And it's not much, because, as I said in the beginning, I think anthropology is more a worldview than a discipline. It's a set of theories, it's a set of methods that I want you to pick what you like. That's why I say never panic when you read an article that's not in your field. I don't care if you don't understand the whole thing. I want you to find what strikes you, what draws you, what makes sense to you, what do you think you can use? Obviously, you know, eventually we'd like to understand the whole thing. But that's not my primary goal. My primary goal, and it's reflected in the assignments for the class, is for you to find what is going to be useful and interesting for you. It's very hard to not get an A in my class because all of my assignments are tailored around you and what you want to do. You know, so it's hard not to do well. Let's see. Okay. So there are a couple of things we're doing during the semester. The first is I'm trying this out for the first time. Blackboard just rejuvenated itself yet again, and it may have been there before, but I never noticed it. There's a section for discussions. You can have forums. And what I'd like to do, I mean, I should just read it before. We're going to divide the group into three groups, and I'll email everyone, or we can just go ABC. In fact, that might be better. We'll do that at the end. A, B, and C. On Blackboard, there are six discussion forums. I've already set them up. So it says, you know, discussion forum week 2, June 1st. The chart here shows when you have been assigned, when your group has been assigned to pose questions. A question. Our class is on a Wednesday. So, for example, week 2. By Monday of week 2, group A, everybody in group A, will pose a question on the discussion forum. It's 1 to 2 paragraphs. Okay. Like, do I hear something? I didn't, my computer was on. It should be related to the readings for that week. You can incorporate things that have happened before. So you can say, I'm having a problem reconciling what we've read this week, specifically blah, 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 with what we've talked about before. Yeah, and bring those two together. And your job is to pose an issue. Or you can say, you know what, this story was in the news last week. It resonates so perfectly. So it doesn't have to be a question. It can be an observation. It can be a comment. It can be, oh my God, they've just discovered another study where they've completely exploited poor third world people by not telling them they weren't being treated. You know, this relates perfectly to these readings for this week. Your job is to throw it out there. I don't grade it. If you do it, you get the 10 points. Or 5, whatever it is. You get 5, you get 10. 10 points. It just has to be done. By that, you know, midnight of that Monday. Responders, their job is to read through all the comments. You don't need to respond to them all. Pick one that grabs you and respond to it. However you want. It doesn't have to be research. You should talk about the readings if it makes sense. You could give a personal anecdote of, oh my God, when I was in Botswana, I saw this happen. And reading this really helped me understand what happened better or how I might do it differently in the future or how ethics should be taught. Whatever. 1 to 2 paragraphs. Just do it. I'm not going to grade it. Nobody's going to grade it. It's just there. After Tuesday, so anytime on Wednesday, you have the opportunity to earn 5 bonus points in the class by just talking about any of the postings, if you feel so inclined. My hope is that, you know, instead of going to Jezebel or Gawker like I do while I'm eating lunch, you know, go to Blackboard and read some of the discussion groups. I want it to be a dynamic living thing that people can constantly come back to. Questions about the online discussion aspect. So each group has 2 question comment posters and 2 times of responding. Okay. In fact, you know what? I don't care about A, B's, and C's. So if you want to look at your calendar, if there's a reason if you're going to be out of town, if it makes more sense to be a B than a C, or if there's some weird thing you have, I hope you've realized by now I am incredibly flexible. obviously, I don't want 28 people to think, well, I want to be an A for week 2 and a C for week 3. That would be a little hard for me. email me what group you want to be in, just so I have a note so I can remember to check. And more importantly, bug you as we get closer to the end of the semester, because it only goes through week 9. Because after that, we have colloquiums and it doesn't make sense, and then I would have had to have 2 groups responding. So just let me know what you want to be, A, B, or C. Okay. And the other thing is critical response papers. These are, at 2 points in the semester, 7 to 10 page critical response. This is a combination research paper, reflection paper. I don't want you to just pick a topic, you know, Google Scholar, search it, find out all the things that have been written about it, and tell me what they say. Interesting, but that's not what I want. A critical response paper is, you do a little bit of that, but you're also, I want you to write with the first person. I want to hear your thoughts on paper. I want to hear the connections that you have made. So a classical research paper is, you know, sort of like what Good says about, you know, people believe this. That's not what I want. I want, I am interested in this topic because ABC. What I find most fascinating about it is this, but how do, you know, how does it relate to this? If there are, sure, go. Oh, thank you. Yeah, perfect. If there are three or four readings that you want to focus on, one of the ways that I often do this to get a critical response paper, let me illustrate. This will make more sense if I illustrate. A classic research paper has the four articles, you pick the main points, you tell me what they are. The paper I want you to write is, you're going to have your thoughts on each of these articles. You're going to disagree with some points. That's fine. I want you to disagree. I want you to dialogue with them. You're going to have questions that are engendered. You're going to have, this makes me think of this. What happens if we put this together with this? Your paper is this, not this. I can read the articles myself and figure out what they say. I don't need you to tell me what the other people are saying. I want to hear what you think about the articles. And you two, I know you've done these before, and I remember the same looks of, this doesn't make any sense. But it's fun. Think of it as liberating. The idea is, again, you have freedom. I want you, you know what? Pretend like you're Art Kaplan. Have you ever read Art Kaplan's MSNBC columns? His better ones have a little bit of academic stuff, a little bit of sort of culture, common knowledge-y kind of stuff. They're written in a way you can understand what he's talking about. He's talking about big ideas in very simple, straightforward language. Whatever's on the left-hand side there, all of your notes in the margins, all the connections you've made, I want you to be Art Kaplan when you sit in front of your computer and think, I'm going to write with authority. I'm going to write with conviction because I care about the topic and I think it's important. I'm not writing a classic research paper. I want you to think one step up from that. But don't panic. If you haven't written these types of papers before and you want to send me a draft, send me a draft. I'll read it. All papers should be emailed to me. I don't want any hard copies of anything, because what I do is I open up my computer, I open up track changes, and I can have a conversation with you on the paper. So sometimes these can go back and forth. I had one student once, he always got so interested in the questions that I had posed back to him that he would answer them and address them, and the paper at the end, you know, was just all track changes and colors. But it was fun. And that's what I want this class to be. I want it to be a constant discussion, thinking. It's not just you need to know information A, B, C. It's learning a different way of thinking and approaching problems. There's an important note there on quoting and citing. And again, because it's on the left-hand side, I don't want to see quote, big quote, unquote, citation, quote, big quote. Again, that's telling me what the author said. I can figure that out myself. I want to know what you think. Questions about those papers? And we can talk about this again next week, but that's just, I think the workload is really manageable. If you send me something over 10 pages, I will not read it. I will send it back to you and make you do it under 10 pages. The references and bibliography can be on page 11, but I don't want to read more than 10. And if you write more than 7, I'll grade you down. That's really the only way you could probably not do very well in this class, is if you keep handing me 5-page reflection papers. That's it. Thank you. I look forward to seeing you next week.